Excuse me, today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. My name is Amanda Hendricks. I'm at JPL, and I'm the host of today's Charm Telecon. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Wayne Pryor from Central Arizona College. Dr. Pryor has been involved in many lines of research, in particular studying aurora from Jupiter and Saturn using data from Galileo and Cassini and Hubble Space Telescope spacecraft, and today he's going to be telling us about Cassini measurements of Saturn's aurora, in particular from the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. So, Wayne, please go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Okay, let me get started.
Thank you.
I'm speaking today from Coolidge, Arizona. A nice warm day here. I'll be talking about Saturn's auroras from the Cassini ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. I guess you're on page one.
Yeah.
I'm going to click to the second page now. I'll be talking a little bit about background of what auroras are, in comparison of Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn auroras. Then I'll get specifically into some of the results we've been getting. The auroras are important. For one reason they're important is because we think they create a great deal of polar haze at Jupiter and Saturn. I'll mention that and where we think that haze is coming from. We'll also talk about how the solar wind varies, how that affects the auroras and how they vary. Make some comparisons with Hubble Space Telescope data. And I'll present some very recent data we've gotten, which shows from a unique perspective with Cassini above the pole of Saturn, we get a very nice view of the auroral ovals. Okay, so if you go to the next slide, a little bit of review. First off, what the solar wind is. The solar wind is a stream of charged particles coming out of the sun at several hundred kilometers per second. It's low density, not very much stuff in the solar wind, a few particles per cubic centimeter at the Earth. The main ingredients in the solar wind are protons and electrons. And then when those charged particles strike planetary atmospheres, there's the potential for auroral emissions, which usually show up at high latitudes on planets. Go to the next slide, please. Now, the auroras are not showing up everywhere on the Earth because the Earth has a magnetic field. And it turns out charged particles do not easily cross magnetic field lines. Instead, they tend to spiral up and down magnetic field lines. So on the Earth, which is more or less a bar magnet in the middle, acts as if there was one, a bar magnet in the middle, it's difficult for charged particles from the sun to strike at low latitudes. However, there are places where they can hit at high latitudes, which leads to the auroral displays we'll talk about. The actual field of the Earth is produced by churning iron down deep inside the core of the Earth. Okay, next slide, please. As the solar wind reaches the Earth, very complicated structures get set up. We call the whole structure the magnetosphere. There's a shock wave upwind as the solar wind is slowed as it gets near the Earth. And then the magnetic field of the Earth is distorted by the interaction with the solar wind, and you get this extended tail going downstream from the Earth. And then you can see up near the top of the Earth and the bottom of the Earth, there are regions, kind of, we call it the cusp, where material might be able to go in directly from the sun and strike and make auroras. Other material from the tails may eventually work its way back in and make auroras. Okay, next slide. This gets us up to slide 6. As I said, the charged particles typically do not cross the field lines very much. Mostly they spiral up and down them. And there are certain active field lines that have currents flowing on them. The currents flow up and down the magnetic field, and then when those currents strike the atmosphere, light is emitted, kind of like in a fluorescent tube where electrons strike gases and make emissions of light. So, next slide, please. So, on the Earth, the auroras make these beautiful displays, as you can see at high latitudes. often colorless, but if you get a particularly bright one, it may seem to have color to you, red or green. Very complicated displays are possible with curtains. Mostly what you're seeing are electrons striking the gases in the atmosphere of the Earth, lighting things up.
Somebody's at my door.
Going to number 8. If you can get above the Earth and look down at the aurora, you'll see that it actually has a lot of structure to it. This is a shuttle image which shows the aurora is organized as kind of a long extended wall of light. One interesting thing here is the top of the emission is red. There are other colors further down, blues and greens. These are different emissions of the atmospheric gases in the Earth's atmosphere. And this picture is taken from 300 kilometers altitude. If you go to the slide 9, the view you get from much further back, where you can now see the Earth as a whole, the oval shows up. That is, the auroras are showing up as a big oval around the pole. And you can see that if you lived, say, in the northern edge of Alaska or somewhere in central Canada, you'd have a pretty good chance of seeing the light displays. It's rare to see them further south. And the aurora really is organized as kind of a circle around, not true north, but magnetic north, which is somewhat offset from the North Pole. So let me go to slide 10 now. Now, my research interest is primarily not the Earth, but you may see some similarities between what you see in slide 10 and what you saw in the previous slide. Jupiter and Saturn also have very remarkable auroras, and they're quite strong. The ones at Jupiter are much stronger than the ones at the Earth, and the ones at Saturn are intermediate in strength between the ones at Jupiter and the Earth. If you look at the Jupiter aurora, which is shown in the image on the right, you'll see that it looks different at the two different ends of the planet. The one on the south end, the bottom end, you see mostly right against the edge of the planet. The one in the north, you can see quite a bit more emission, see an oval facing you more. And the reason they're quite different north and south is because the magnetic field of Jupiter is quite distorted. It's not a simple dipole magnet field. The one on Saturn, as you can see, is more confined to the polar region on both poles, a somewhat simpler magnetic field. Another thing I want you to notice in these pictures is that if you get away from the light that's showing up at the ends of the planet, the background clouds are actually kind of dark at high latitudes. That's true for both Jupiter and its Saturn. And we think those background clouds are dark because of chemical reactions that are triggered by the auroras that make dark material in the atmosphere. Going to slide 11.
So, Wayne, when you're talking about the dark material, it's kind of in the area surrounding the aurora ring?
Yes.
The aurora ring? Okay.
It's kind of like the smoke around a fire. So if you can see those bright emissions in the picture, the dark material near it is sort of the smoke that's been produced as a result of reactions in the aurora.
Thanks.
Okay, number 11 kind of summarizes some of the differences between the three planets we're talking about. On the Earth, the auroras seem to mostly be controlled by the solar wind, which kind of organizes everything and produces most of the material that's involved in the auroras. On Jupiter, it's quite a bit different. Most of the material that's around there actually comes from one of the moons of Jupiter, the moon Io, which has active volcanoes which are spitting out sulfur and oxygen, some of which makes it out into space and then fills the region around Jupiter. And the plasma created from that sulfur and oxygen is what ultimately ends up hitting the atmosphere and making the auroras that you saw in that previous slide. Now, on Saturn, we're still trying to figure out what's going on a little more. But it seems to be true that there is solar wind effects on Saturn, as I'll show it later. And there's also a lot of internal material there at Saturn. That is stuff around Saturn, mostly oxygen and hydrogen, which come from water. And the source of that water is a couple of places. One place is Saturn's rings, which are rich in water ice. And the other is the moon Enceladus, which we've learned from Cassini has active geysers that are shooting out water into space. So those are our sources for a lot of the material that's going to show up in the magnetosphere. Some of that material later is ionized and then strikes Saturn and makes the auroras on Saturn.
So the material from Io or Enceladus then can get sort of picked up and travel along the field lines into the polar regions?
That's it, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, going to slide 12. I'll be mentioning today mostly data from the Cassini UVIS. I'll also briefly mention something from VIMS. These are a couple of the instruments bolted to the Cassini orbiter, which is shown in the picture on the left. The UVIS is in, I guess that's sort of a pink color there, arrow pointing to it. It's bolted to the spacecraft. You want to look at something, you have to turn the whole spacecraft. On the right is the blow-up of the instrument, the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, which has several channels on it. I'll be talking about results from a couple of the spectral channels today, the extreme ultraviolet and the far ultraviolet channels. And there you can see the buffalo on there. That's from the University of Colorado mascot. This was built at the University of Colorado. Going to number 13 now, we've got some sample data from this instrument from two of the channels, the extreme ultraviolet channel and the far ultraviolet channel. And it's fairly complicated. What you're seeing is data on the detectors for each channel, making an array which in one axis or one dimension is spatial information along the spectrometer's entrance slit. The other axis is spectral information, information about the different wavelengths of light that's present. And in the one on the left, that's the EUV channel, you'll see towards the middle, something like spatial pixel 32, 33, somewhere in there, you'll see a bright band of light going left to right. Those are emissions coming from Saturn. Those are excited emissions from hydrogen molecules in the atmosphere. Similarly, in the figure on the right, you follow over pixel 32, 33, spatial pixel 32, 33, you'll see again the yellow emissions going left to right, which are, again, hydrogen that's been excited at Saturn. The hydrogen is excited by electrons hitting it, primarily in the auroral regions. You'll also see a blob a little further down to the lower in the right side over near 1800 angstroms and spatial pixels like 20 to 30. That's reflected sunlight from the planet Saturn. So we have information about reflected sunlight as well as information about the auroras coming into the instrument. Also notice around 1200 angstroms, just to the right of it at 1216 angstroms, you'll see a yellow stripe going up and down all the way across the spatial direction, and that's hydrogen, atomic hydrogen in space near Saturn. Also some of it is on Saturn. Okay, going to number 14, which shows the slit I mentioned previously, pasted on the planet. In this case, you're pointing at Saturn, and then data is recorded up and down that slit in different spatial pixels. There are 64 spatial pixels along the slit. And then for each of those spatial pixels, we get a spectrum. Sometimes we just do this, obtain spectra this way. Other occasions, the slit is slowly moved back and forth sideways which allows us to build up images. So in some cases, we have images of Saturn and spectra for each location in those images. So there's a lot of information in the data set. Now, in the picture you see in front of you, there's a little bit of green inside the slit. Those are actually emissions from Saturn showing up there. On the northern end, it's auroral light. On the southern end is auroral light. In the middle, there's some reflected sunlight showing up. The auroral emissions are showing up from molecular hydrogen and from atomic hydrogen. The reflected sunlight you're seeing is actually created by scattering in the atmosphere off cloud particles and off molecular hydrogen. And on top of that, there are actually some absorption features we can pull out of the data. The absorption features tell us about gases in the atmosphere. One of the main ones we've spotted there is acetylene, which acetylene is C2H2, a hydrocarbon gas. Okay, so going to slide 15 now. I mentioned you can make images. Here's an example where images were constructed just about the time Cassini got to Saturn. That's July 2004. The image on the top is an ultraviolet image of Saturn at the atomic line of hydrogen. The image in the bottom is molecular bands of H2. And they look a little bit different. And the reason for that is because there is atomic hydrogen out in space around Saturn, and not much molecular hydrogen. That atomic hydrogen in space, if you look at the top picture, you can see there's sort of a blocky region around Saturn, outside of the rings. It's a little bit brighter than the rest of the frame, and that's actually atomic hydrogen in an extended region around Saturn. And atomic hydrogen fills that region. Eventually, some of that will be ionized and available to make auroral emissions at the planet. The source of that hydrogen, we're not so sure about. Some of it's coming from the rings. Some of it's probably coming from the atmosphere of the planet. How much of each, we're still trying to figure out. And at the ends of the planet, you can see the auroras showing up in both the top and the bottom picture. Okay, going to slide 16. We've taken a look at how extended that hydrogen cloud is. And what is shown here is how much light is present as you move away from Saturn in the hydrogen channels. And that's the black one's probably the most interesting one here. It shows that if you look at the black curve, which is an equatorial cut across the previous sorts of pictures, that the amount of hydrogen declines as you go away from Saturn, but there's hydrogen present all the way out to at least 40 Saturn radii out. So there's a big cloud of hydrogen extending out into space around Saturn. Okay, going to number 17. We've also obtained a lot of UVIS images that emphasize atomic oxygen, which shows up at 1,304 angstroms, or 130 nanometers. And again, it has sort of this wider than tall appearance, where you see material which is atomic oxygen in the region around Saturn. Saturn is marked here as a circle. You can see the rings are marked on here. And there are a couple of yellow blobs well away from Saturn, which are atomic oxygen out in space. So again, this is a water product. Oxygen, like hydrogen, can come from water. And it's filling the magnetosphere and is available there to become ionized. And then some of that material can move up and down the field lines and strike Saturn and make auroras. Okay, going to number 18, showing you the kinds of spectral information we get. Here we've compared Jupiter's spectrum and Saturn's spectrum. And you can look hard for differences, and there aren't very many. They're both very similar. In terms of just the up and down variations, there are many wiggles there. Those are different wiggles, which are due to transitions in molecular hydrogen from a couple of the band systems of molecular hydrogen, the Werner and Lyman band systems. There is, however, a significant difference between the two. We've had to scale them. Jupiter was reduced in brightness, Saturn was increased in brightness, because generally the Jupiter auroras are much brighter than the Saturn auroras. I like a factor of 100 or more. Jupiter has very intense auroral emissions. Going to number 19.
Before you leave 18, could you
yes.
tell me what the intensity is measured in? KR per A?
Okay, the units are kilorales per angstrom.
Okay.
A rayleigh is a measure of brightness.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, going to number 19. Here's another spectrum of Saturn. This one, I wanted to show that it's the spectrum of Saturn is actually somewhat similar to a laboratory spectrum obtained in the laboratory at Colorado, where they took the instrument into the lab, put it in a vacuum chamber, and ran a current through hydrogen gas. And that produced the red spectrum, which is rather similar to the black spectrum you get from Saturn. There are a few differences. And the long wavelengths are quite a bit different because Saturn also has reflected sunlight, which is what shows up at the long end. Another difference is that there are absorbing gases in the atmosphere of Saturn, primarily methane, which absorbs some of that shorter wavelength light on Saturn. And we can actually model that, which is shown as the sort of brownish-orange color. We've added some methane into a model, put it above the lab spectrum, and the comparison is pretty good to the actual data. There are some discrepancies we argue about, which may be due to other absorbers, but we're still trying to figure some of that out. Okay, going to number 20. The extreme ultraviolet spectrum of Jupiter and Saturn are shown here. The solid is Saturn. The dashed is Jupiter. Again, they're very similar. There's also a dotted spectrum shown as the top curve there, which is a lab spectrum, again, where electrons were fired through hydrogen gas and viewed with the instrument. Some differences there, but again, they're similar enough to be convinced that it's molecular hydrogen. The differences are pretty well understood in terms of self-absorption and the very thick hydrogen gas on these gas giant planets. And I'll show models of that later where we can actually fit that spectrum. Number 21. Here's a case where we were able to do extremely good imaging of Saturn, where the UVA slit was moved up and down. It was aligned east-west and moved up and down to create two images of Saturn. Now, these have been fairly heavily processed, but this is real data where it's been color-coded here so that the orange shows reflected sunlight coming from the rings of Saturn and the atmosphere of Saturn. And the blue is showing the atomic and molecular hydrogen emissions from the auroras. These two images were taken about an hour apart. And you can see by comparing the two that the blue region at the bottom has changed somewhat. Different parts of it are brighter in one than in the other. Particularly the changes are most obvious inside the oval, where we think the auroras are more directly tied to changes in solar wind conditions. And those things change fairly quickly. We were actually able to use deconvolution, it turned out, to make these images look fairly crisp using some canned deconvolution algorithms that are available in the language IDL.
Pardon me, I have a question.
Please.
Could you clarify what you just said a minute ago, that the earlier you mentioned that the particles, the aurora was not from the solar wind particles, they were from particles that are near Saturn. But I think you just mentioned that solar wind does play a part in the auroras of Saturn. Could you clarify the difference between that?
Yeah, I wish I could. We're still trying to figure out what's what here. And I went to a meeting last week in Iowa where we argued about what's what in there. But
okay.
It's usually true that the stuff right near the pole is more likely to be solar wind material.
Okay.
And the stuff further from the pole is more likely to be tied to the magnetospheres of Saturn and the material from, say, Enceladus or the ring. So the main ring there may be more tied to Saturn-related material, and then the central stuff might be more tied to changes in the solar wind. We're still trying to decide if that's true or not.
Okay, great. Do the two interact? Can the solar wind cause variation in the other particles as well?
It probably does. It probably compresses the whole field, which will affect how many precipitate and how many come on down to the atmosphere.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay, going to number 22, where I've shown with a latitude grid more or less where the auroras are coming from. In this case, it's something like 70 to 75 degrees south, so it's fairly close to the pole along the oval. It's a pretty high latitude emission. Going to number 23. Now we're using images from a different instrument. This is the camera on Cassini, the ISS. And I want you to call your attention first off to the fact that it's generally kind of dark in the polar region. And there's something very strange right in the middle of that dark area. There's a concentration of dark material right at the south pole of Saturn, which is pretty interesting stuff. And I think it has something to do with the auroras, as I'll try to explain in a minute here. So let's go to number 24. This is a better view from the camera of that south polar storm. I like to think of this as like a bathtub drain. I think it's a region of downwelling, where material is going down and being concentrated. I think dark material that was produced over a large region, say under the auroras, has now been concentrated inside this sort of funnel and making this area seem rather dark. I really love this picture. It's a beautiful storm. And it turns out the spectrum we got right at this spot was quite a bit different than our other spectra. I've been trying to understand that for a while now. Going to number 25. Talking a little bit more now about this haze business. As I mentioned earlier, there seems to be a lot of haze around the auroral zones. The figure on the lower right is information from two previous spacecraft at Jupiter. One was from Voyager, which is the photopolarimeter, called PPS here. And the other was data from the Galileo ultraviolet spectrometer. What is shown there cuts across the planet going north-south, showing how reflective the atmosphere is at different latitudes. And what it's showing you is that at very high latitudes at both poles, it gets quite dark. That is, that's the dark-absorbing haze material. And on Jupiter, the dark-absorbing haze material is dark over a wide range of latitudes near the North Pole, down to, say, 40 or 50 north. On the South Pole, it's not quite so extended in latitude. And that difference, we think, has to do with the difference in the auroras. That is, the aurora is spread over a lot of latitudes in the north. The aurora is confined to polar latitudes in the south. So it leads to a broader region of haze in the north and a smaller region of haze in the south. And that was seen from a couple of spacecraft almost 20 years apart. Okay, going to number 26. On Saturn, again, there's a relationship between the aurora and the haze. You can see in the Hubble picture. And now I've got, on the right, I've got Voyager data for two planets, Jupiter, which I just showed you, and now I've got Saturn on there also. Saturn also gets dark toward the poles, over by 90 on the right in latitude. You can see the reflectivity I over F drops down below 0.1, but only for a fairly limited range of latitudes. That is, only at high latitudes on Saturn is there much of this haze. It's fairly well confined to the region near the auroral oval. So we think there's a connection between the aurora and the haze. So far it's just coincidence in geography, but I think there's more to this story than that. When you go to 27, it talks about a little bit about modeling efforts that have been made to understand this haze-making process. A number of groups have worked on this, and the story seems to be that if you take methane and you ionize it in the auroral regions, that chemistry has started that leads to formation of polymers, that is, long-chain hydrocarbons, that eventually can make hazes. And so we think that those dark regions are full of hydrocarbon haze in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter and Saturn. One of the important molecules that is expected to come out of this process is benzene, the basic ring compound in organic chemistry. It's got six carbons and six hydrogens. And we think that benzene would be a good starting place to make multiple ring polymers and produce haze particles. And some of the chemists who've looked at this think that benzene should be very important. So we looked at the data set we had from 2005, day 172, which I showed you a minute ago. That was the one that had an orange planet and blue haze at the poles, and blue auroras at the poles. And that one had a very nice spectrum right at the polar region, which we were able to test to see if there were any unusual compounds in that. So I'm going to number 28 now. This is one where the PDF file is a little bit perturbed. You'll notice that the wavelength numbers are not in a straight line anymore. That probably needs to be fixed eventually. But what is shown there are images at different wavelength bins from the Cassini-Uvis data. The one on the left shows wavelength 1738 to 1816. If you look hard there, you'll notice it's extremely dark right at the pole in both of those passes across the pole. It's quite dark. If you look at the next one over, which is supposed to read 1816 to 1894 angstroms, it's actually been overlapping some other words in mine, unfortunately. This one does not show a dark spot right at the pole, although it's generally dark. The third image shows a ratio of those two images, emphasizing that there's a very dark spot right at the pole. This was unexpected. This was just something I was looking around to see what kinds of things were in the data. We found there was a wavelength bin. The one on the left, 1738 to 1816, where it was quite a bit darker right at the pole. And then the fourth image shown there shows you where the aurora is. You can see the dark spot in the third image is actually somewhat inside the auroral region. So we think that dark spot there corresponds to that dark eye I showed you a minute ago in the camera images. So it's showing up as an unusual ultraviolet feature as well as an unusual camera feature. Then the spectrum shown here is a ratio spectrum, and we've compared the spectrum of that dark spot to the region around it. And the data is kind of noisy. I would like to get more spectra like this and clean it up later. But there is a general broad dip centered around 1750. And we think that that general broad dip is due to benzene, which is concentrated. It's produced by the aurora and then concentrated by the circulation pattern, and concentrated at right at that south polar spot. Going to number 29. It turns out we have good sensitivity to benzene in our data. The bottom panel shows how strongly benzene absorbs at different wavelengths. It turns out it absorbs quite strongly at the wavelengths where we're seeing our dip. Also shown is the absorption cross-section for acetylene, that is C2H2, which has a lot more structure, a lot of wiggles in it. And we think both of those are contributing to what we actually see on Saturn. So on the top one, we've actually modeled the dip. The way we model the dip is to put some benzene in, and put some acetylene in, and we can actually fit the observed spectrum by putting a fair amount of benzene right at the pole. We think, again, that benzene is produced by the auroras. So this is kind of a Cassini discovery. We think there's enhanced benzene right at the poles on Saturn. Benzene had previously been detected in the global average from, I believe it was the ISO spacecraft. Okay, going to number 30.
Quick question, Wayne. When you
yes.
when you say it's a mixing model with, you know, particular amount of benzene, is it easy to tell us what the other stuff is that you put in there?
It's also got acetylene. It's got two absorbers.
Okay, just the two. Okay.
Yeah. And that seems to fit what's going on.
Okay, cool.
Okay, going to number 30, there's another instrument on the spacecraft which should be able to see benzene. That's Cassini-Sears, the infrared instrument. And I checked with them to see if they were seeing enhanced benzene at the polar region, and they also reported seeing enhanced benzene at the polar region. So that's a confirmation that there seems to be more benzene there being produced by the auroral chemistry. And that's shown here. There's a C6H6 on this figure with an up and down bar pointing toward a little feature in the spectrum. I guess it's near wave number 674, where they confirm they're seeing some benzene there near the polar region. This is at 80 south in their data. So I think that story is coming together, that there is enhanced benzene at the polar region. Okay, going to number 31. Now I'm going to start talking about solar wind time dependence in the aurora. Here we got some data taken during an unusual opportunity when the spacecraft was out in the solar wind and we were able to observe the aurora at the same time. So we could see what's happening in the solar wind and then see how that affects the aurora itself. Most of the mission, we can't do this. But for this brief period, we had the right geometry to do this over about 50 days. Going to number 32. This is a little hard to explain, but what's shown here is the brightness seen in UVIS as a function of day and a function of spatial pixel. You'll see that about spatial pixel 30 going left to right across, there's a bright band. That's the south pole, the southern aurora on Saturn. There's also an arc going across, which is also bright, going from the N on the left side to the N on the right side. That's the northern auroral oval. And the size of the planet changed over this period on the detector because the spacecraft was moving with respect to Saturn. Sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's smaller. And I've marked on there a solar wind shock. I think it's like day 207. And in response to that solar wind shock, when a pressure pulse came by in the solar wind, the auroras got substantially brighter. And there are other examples in there of brightening events. When it brightens at one pole, it seems to brighten at both poles, as you might expect. Okay, going to number 33. Here we have the same information from UVIS plotted in the top panel, that is how bright the aurora was on different days. And again, I've got that shock marked. Shock is marked on the bottom of this, and there's actually a second shock that's showing up here, where you can see brightening events in the UVIS data. So it's interesting to see what else was going on. There are other instruments on the spacecraft that can tell us about solar wind conditions. The second panel shows what's labeled SKR. This is radio data from the spacecraft. And the radio data is sensitive to the auroras also because the auroras produce radio noise. And I think you can see that during the shock events, there is a little bit of extra radio noise produced. The third and fourth panels show the magnetic field changes. Again, about where that shock is marked, you can see the magnetic field jumps strongly and stays high for a while. Tapers off, then it jumps again about day 230-something. You can see at least a couple of shocks in here where the magnetic field jumps. The bottom two panels are showing the solar wind conditions. In this case, it's the proton densities and velocities. You can see the densities jump dramatically at those shocks. So you suddenly have a lot more protons, higher magnetic field, and that increased pressure seems to drive the aurora to brighten. Going to number 34. Several times during the mission, we've been able to coordinate Hubble observations of Saturn with Cassini observations. This slide has some details on the first of these campaigns when Hubble, with the ACS, an instrument which is now dead on Hubble, was able to image the southern aurora. Same time Cassini was imaging the northern aurora, or taking spectra of the northern aurora, I should say. And going to slide 35, you can see auroral images from Hubble. These are a little bit better spatial information than we ever get out of Cassini. So you can get some idea of some of the details. You can see the arcs are not entirely complete. Some patches of the arcs are brighter than others. And from frame to frame, things change. In general, this was considered a weak aurora day. There have been days when a lot more was going on Saturn's auroras. Going to number 36, this shows where the UVIS was looking at the same time. So while the camera was looking at the sunlit pole, we were looking at the night side pole with UVIS, and going to 37 shows where we'd obtained data. I've marked on here in red places where we saw the aurora, in green are places where we did not see the aurora. And again, you can see that the auroras are showing up at latitudes between, say, 70 and 80 latitude. In this case now, it's just the northern aurora, as seen from UVIS. Going to slide 38, it shows the spectrum we got at this time, which looks a lot like the spectrum you get in the laboratory with electrons hitting hydrogen. So during this campaign, we succeeded in getting a nice spectrum to go along with the images from Hubble. And we'll be working that up with some detailed models. If you go to slide 39, this shows one of those detailed models produced by Jack Gustin at the University of Colorado, where he's been able to fit the details of the extreme ultraviolet spectrum, with the solid brown being the model, black being the data, and very good agreement is seen in fitting the features in there. The features that are showing up show up as a result of a process called self-absorption in hydrogen gas. Dashed line shows you what you would see if there was no self-absorption, and it's quite a bit different from the spectrum that's seen, which tells us that the aurora is showing up from a significant column of hydrogen. That is, it's produced fairly deep in the atmosphere, and a hydrogen column of about 5 times 10 to the 20th per square centimeter, and at a temperature in the upper atmosphere of about 500 Kelvin. The upper atmosphere is fairly warm there. Okay, going to number 40, some of the fairly recent stuff. Here's an image obtained when the spacecraft was finally able to get well above the plane of Saturn rings and look down the auroras as a whole. And this nice image shows that the ring is auroral arc, makes a pretty much complete oval. There's even a nice little bright spot inside of it, which again is probably tied to things in the solar wind, features in the solar wind. We haven't got very many of these images yet, but they're very valuable to look at. Going to number 41. This is a piece of a movie we got on day 96 of this year. And I'm showing the geometry in this slide. We're looking at the northern aurora, and that little frame in there with the red and the blue actually shows the auroral emissions on the planet.
So is this a similar geometry to the one on the or on slide 40?
To say again?
Is it a similar geometry? Are we looking at the same kind of thing then?
Similar sorts of geometry to the previous
okay.
one, yeah.
But just a different color scheme you're showing.
Yeah, I'm playing with colors.
Okay.
Nice thing about this newer one is there were 9 images obtained, and I'll show those in a minute, which is enough to look for variations. And the images, each one took about 2 hours to obtain, and they were obtained over a long enough period that Saturn had completely rotated and started to repeat itself. So we could start to look for effects due to Saturn rotation. Okay, so going to number 42, which shows those 9 frames in this first movie we got. And these frames, are, again, are about 2 hours apart. Saturn is rotating something like 10 hours. So this is long enough that you get more than one rotation of Saturn showing up, slightly more than one rotation. And the patterns start to repeat. And you can see the patterns are different from frame to frame. There's a lot going on in here. We're trying to figure out this picture. A few things I can say about it just from looking at it here. There are some spiral structures that show up. There are multiple arcs that show up, more than one auroral arc. In a couple of cases, you can see light inside the oval. There's a lot of fun things to try to figure out. And then, as I'll show in a minute, some of the patterns actually repeat after an orbit, after a rotation, rather. Going to number 43, this one is a polar projection of the data that was previously shown, where now I've got things laid out so that the repeating patterns are above each other. So, for example, the one on the top left goes with the one on the bottom left. The next one over goes with the one below it, and so on. We're trying to see if things repeat. And there definitely are some repetitions showing up in the patterns that are going on. In general, the auroras are brighter on the dawn side, but some things seem to be rotating around. So to help the eyeball on that, I've drawn a little spiral on there in black, which is at a fixed set of latitudes and longitudes, tracing out some of the brighter features, and I watched to see it rotate around to see if those features would in fact rotate around. And it looks to me like there is some stuff rotating around, but as it's doing so, it becomes dimmer as it gets around to the bottom, which is the dusk side. And it becomes brighter again when it gets back around to the top or the dawn side. So we think on the dawn side, things are more compressed, and that seems to drive auroral emission, whereas on the dusk side, things are more expanded and they're less likely to have auroral emission. But there are blobs rotating around this movie clip we got. Okay, going to number 44. This is the same movie now, shown in the bottom, frames going across from 1 through 9. And above it now is data from a different instrument, the INCA instrument, which is measuring energetic neutral hydrogen near Saturn, in the magnetosphere of Saturn, in the ring plane. And what I want you to notice is that their data has spiral structures in it, and the UVIS data has spiral structures in it, and we're in the process of trying to see if they're related. So, for example, if you look on their top row there, the second frame over shows a fairly bright orange and red blob. Go over five frames to the right, you again see a fairly bright orange and red blob. So that's a pattern that's repeated after a rotation. Similarly, if you go down and look at the UVIS frames, patterns kind of repeat after about five. If you look at the one on the bottom left and you go over five frames, the pattern again is kind of repeated. So we think things are rotating around, and they become active when they get to the dawn side. And we think there are connections between what's seen in the ring plane and what's seen in the auroral zone, which is telling us in this case that we think that the auroral emission is tied to the ring plane emission and not directly to the solar wind, which was kind of puzzling to some people who've been putting the other story forward, that it was more solar wind control. Going to number 45, this shows the orbit that was involved for this period, showing where Cassini was moving in space during this period. The date in question was day 96, which I think if you're maybe a little bit small to see here, but if you can find day 96 on there, you can see where the spacecraft was at that time. And the reason we carefully looked at the spacecraft trajectory is we're trying to see if Cassini was anywhere near the right place to be sitting on an active field line. That is a field line that's creating the aurora. We would love to be at one of those situations where you're on the auroral field line measuring the particles at the same time you're watching the aurora in the atmosphere, and we haven't pulled that off yet. Turns out we just missed on this occasion. Going to number 46, it shows you where the trajectory maps on to the planet. And it turns out that on day 96, which is the day of the observation, the spacecraft was not actually on the field line that was making light. It was actually somewhat inside of it. So I've marked in red there at the bottom of all this that we were just inside the UVIS oval at that time. That is, the spacecraft was not sampling active field lines. So the particle and field instruments can't tell us too much about the aurora on that day, although we'll keep trying during the rest of the mission to see if we can get a coordinated observation where we get the auroral emissions at the same time we measure the fields and particles data from the spacecraft on that field line.
So the plot on page 46 is showing us how...
Showing you where on the auroral, where on the planet, where on the ionosphere the field line hits. So if you see number 96 there, day 96, you see that dot? That falls between 5 degrees and 10 degrees from the pole. Something like 7 or 8 degrees. And at that time, the auroral emission was not getting that close to the pole. So we were not on an active field line that day. Assuming, of course, that the model for the magnetosphere is reliable. But as I'll show in a minute, it looks like we really did have a quiet day in the magnetic field. Not much was happening that day. So I'm going to go to number...
Sort of showing the trajectory of Cassini mapped onto the...
mapped onto the ionosphere, onto the planet itself.
Okay.
I wasn't that clear on that, sorry. Okay, going to number 47. This shows some of the magnetic field data for this day. And day 96 is the day in question. Magnetic field does not change much on that day. There's not a whole lot going on. There are other days when there was a lot more activity, if you look along in time, and those might have been days when we actually were on active field lines. But day 96, when we had the good auroral observations, was not a good day in terms of the particle and field measurements. Going to 48, it emphasizes that point. Again, we've blown up that period in the magnetic field data. And there's a little bit of action about hour 4, but really not very much is happening in the purple region. It's a pretty quiet day in the magnetic field. Not a lot going on. We need to try that experiment a few more times to see if we can actually catch an active field line while we're looking at the auroral emissions. So number 49 kind of summarizes the results from that first auroral movie we've gotten. Again, it's a 9-frame movie. It shows the auroras at times that have multiple arcs. There's a fair amount of spiraling structure. The auroras are showing up at 70 to 80 north. Generally brighter on the dawn side. And it looks like we missed being on an active field line. That is, we did not actually catch the auroral particles, the auroral fields, while we were measuring that aurora. The Inca comparisons are kind of interesting. Inca shows spirals, which are actually spiraling outwards, while the spirals that we see are spiraling inwards. And that sounds strange, but what that actually turns out to make sense is that as you get further out from the planet, the field lines actually map in closer to the pole. It turns out that the pattern in the spirals we're seeing kind of makes sense, although we have not yet done the detailed mapping to see if we can map one structure directly onto another. That's work in progress. We also saw some repeating patterns, which suggest there are blobs rotating around in longitude. So things are kind of controlled by the magnetosphere, that is, they're rotationally controlled. But the fact that we saw it always brighter on the dawn side says that there also is some role the solar wind is playing. It controls local time effects like that. In the future, we'll be able to use the spectral information, try to decide just how energetic those electrons were that made that map, and we'll do that in the future. Okay, going to number 50. Reminding you that there are other instruments on Cassini. Here's another one called VIMS, which is also getting auroral images. This one was provided by Kevin Baines, showing you that this other instrument is also showing nice auroral images. This is, in this case, emissions from H3+ ions in the atmosphere, Saturn. So we're still trying to coordinate to get decent images. Well, they're getting decent images, that they don't always work out that well because they have different strategies than we do. But it's nice that there are more than one instrument available to take this kind of image of the aurora on Saturn. Okay, number 51. Since I turned this presentation in to Amanda last week, we've actually gotten two more of these movies, which are not on your PowerPoint, but I'll tell you, we've got them in hand. They look nice, so we're going to have more of these movies to release in the future. One nice thing I'm seeing in the new stuff is there's a lot of activity right in the middle of the Auroral Oval again, perhaps more so than before. So we're going to have fun figuring out what we're seeing there. So this is an active period for the aurora right now. Unfortunately, we had apparently some rain yesterday. Some of the data was lost, but I guess that's the luck of the draw. Okay, going to number 52, summarizing the talk. We've been able to image the aurora from UVIS. The VIMS instrument has also been imaging it. We can fit what we're seeing in the spectrum with models that include self-absorption in molecular hydrogen and some hydrocarbon absorbers, primarily methane. We've seen the auroras respond to solar wind changes. We've identified a small spot in the data right at the South Pole where there's a storm on Saturn, and that spot seems to have enhanced acetylene and probably benzene, which is showing up in that dark spot, a certain wavelength range. And the nice thing that's going on now is Cassini's finally at high latitudes. We're getting direct views of the auroras. So we're going to be able to finally learn a little bit more about what's controlling the auroras. Are they controlled internally from material from Enceladus and the rings, or is it mostly solar wind-driven stuff? And what I think is going on now is probably a little bit of both is going on. At dawn, things get brighter, but a lot of the blobs of material are repeating from orbit to orbit. And I think that concludes my talk. Slide 53 just has a list of references, and I should open the floor to any questions you guys have.
Thanks a lot, Wayne. That's really interesting. Are there questions?
Mute? Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
When you talk about these different days and dawns and so forth, how are you measuring a day on Saturn?
Okay.
What's the reference point of this? That's the current.
We usually do our planning in terms of Earth days. So like day 96, and I'd say that refers to Earth day 96, which is 24-hour Earth days.
Okay.
And not a Saturn day.
Thanks.
So when you, I'm going to chime in with a question here. When you say that there's probably a contribution from both the solar wind and the Saturn system stuff, like the rings and Enceladus, you're saying that the contribution from the solar wind is evident by the brightening in the dawn location?
Yeah.
And then the sort of blobs that move around would be the maybe the Enceladus material that's accumulated?
That's right.
Okay.
I think you understand as well as I do, which is not too well at this point. Don Mitchell said that we just happened to get lucky and get one day when there was a structure that was moving around that was well organized for that movie. Most of the time it's more chaotic than that.
Do you expect that if there's contributions from Enceladus materials that would be a way to track Enceladus activity?
He said it doesn't really track all that well, so I guess it feeds in over a long enough period of time. It's not bursty enough that you can easily trace it to Enceladus directly.
Right, but the Enceladus, well, we don't know if Enceladus is bursting or not, right?
Okay.
But
more to learn.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess that would be a really, really long-term experiment.
Yeah, well, he says it's not that easy to instantly trace it to Enceladus' location. There are other things that are going on.
Right. Because is the blob, is it like an Enceladus footprint, like an Io footprint?
There was a search for an Enceladus footprint reported on at the meeting I attended. Apparently a student at BU is doing her thesis on that. And if there is a footprint from Enceladus, it's very faint. It's not a bright not like there's a strong current between Enceladus and Saturn like there is for Io and Jupiter.
So it would be more just that material is lost from Enceladus.
Yeah, and it takes probably takes okay. some time to ionize it after it leaves Enceladus.
Right,
too.
Right. Are there other questions?
I have a question. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
How do we know that the Earth's aurora isn't from, you know, particles that are other than the solar wind?
There is some contribution from Earth's upper atmospheric gases also. And there's some mixture of material in there on the Earth. But when I say it's solar wind control, that mostly is referring now to the fact that things are usually show strong local time effects. The auroras seem to brighten up toward midnight, and they're strongly tied to the local time rather than blobs rotating around in longitude.
Thank you. What about large variations in solar wind or things going on in the sun? Has there been any studies of what that relationship Saturn's aurora?
Yeah, I think I showed a couple of those where I mentioned shocks going by. Those are basically outbursts on the sun that have propagated all the way out there. It takes a few days to get out there. And once they get out there, it shows up as a pressure pulse. So this is originally it was a coronal mass ejection at the sun, and it takes after some days it gets out to Earth and then eventually on out to Saturn, and you can see a pressure pulse as that material finally goes through and you get more density, more magnetic field usually, and that seems to trigger a brightening in the aurora.
I wasn't quite sure if that pulse was from a coronal mass ejection.
I think so. In some cases, those pulses actually end up being from more than one coronal mass ejection because they kind of catch up with each other.
Okay.
Other questions?
I have a question. As Cassini gets to higher latitudes, is that going to help get greater resolution or spectral data on that polar dark spot?
Yeah, I keep hoping we get better information on that polar dark spot. It seems to have been a very ideal observation we got on that one day, and so far that's the best data I've seen on it. But I'm going to try and get more data like that, so at least that good quality.
Thank
so
you.
We can get I want that spectrum cleaned up, so I'm working on that.
Good. Thanks.
Speaking of the polar dark spot, is I don't really see it jumping out at me in the VIMS image. I see a ring, but I don't see a dark spot. Is there any?
Oddly enough, I wasn't going to get into it, but oddly enough, that VIMS image is the other end of Saturn, and they did a press release recently, and I shouldn't be the one to give this talk, but they did a press release recently where they saw a hexagon.
Okay. Right.
At the northern end. So the northern end of Saturn has a hexagon, the south end has an eyeball and a drain.
Gotcha. Okay.
Whatever that means, I don't know yet.
Okay, so your dark spot is at the South Pole.
Right.
Huh, wow.
Regarding the dark spot at the South Pole, I thought I had saw a press release that had mentioned that we're seeing deeper, part of the reason it's dark is we're able to see deeper down into Saturn's atmosphere from the downswelling. And from what you described here with the benzene, that may not be the case.
Well, my ideas may be wrong on that too. We still have to sort out what we're seeing and what depth it's at. Downwelling regions in general cause clearings in the clouds, so you would see the deeper depths.
Okay.
And that would lead to more absorption at certain wavelengths.
You're
absolutely right about that.
Thanks. One more question. Did you have anything to say about this hexagon?
I have no idea why it's there or why it really does look like a hexagon. It's not something you normally expect in a fluid. But it was there in Voyager also. So it's a persistent feature. That may be one helpful thing. Whatever it is, has been there a long time.
Okay. Any final questions? Well, thanks again so much, Wayne, for this really interesting talk and for giving us all the latest info on your research.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Wayne.
Okay, bye.
And to everybody else, thanks for calling in, and we will see you or hear from you hopefully next month when we'll have the third anniversary Charm Telecon with an overview of all of the results or the highlights of the mission to date over the last 3 years. So that'll be happening on the last Tuesday in June. I think it's the 29th. I don't have my calendar in front of me. It's the 26th, June 26th, but we'll be sending out an email about that. So thanks very much, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thanks.